jamais comment les choses vont se dérouler. On sait jamais comment les choses. C'est pourquoi, pourquoi les choses se démènent comme ça. C'est pourquoi, pourquoi les choses.
You are listening to CKUT 90.3 FM on November 18th, 2020. It's about 6 p.m. And this is In the Motherhood. I'm your host, Robin Fadden. That song you heard was Ha Ha Happiness by Montreal group Les Chouettes. You can find them online at kristamuir.bandcamp.com. It's a pretty fun way to open the show, which is kind of about serious things. So on today's In the Motherhood here on CKUT, we're talking about a couple of the issues that lower and moderate income families are facing here in Montreal. And one of those issues is the housing crisis, specifically eviction and repossession notices, and how the incidence of that has increased in the past year. I spoke with Amy Darwish earlier this year, and she works with the Comité d'Action de Parc Extension. She talked to me about the major challenges and stresses that lower income renters are facing right now when we have such a low vacancy rate in Montreal. It's the lowest it's been in 15 years, and the rents are increasing. And so this situation is happening right now as we approach the holiday season. We're seeing more new developments being proposed and being built with rent expectations that are outside of moderate and lower income range, especially when it comes to families who need larger apartments to live in, of course. So we're seeing more rent evictions, as it's called, and very few, if any, social housing initiatives that many neighborhoods are asking for. So I'll get to this interview with Amy Darwish. So thank you for listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. First, if you could introduce yourself and let us know who you are, what your role is here, and then we'll get into some of the issues that you've been dealing with lately.
Sure. So I'm Amy Darwish. I'm a community organizer at the Comité d'Action de Parc Extension. The Comité d'Action de Parc Extension is a group that supports park extension residents in defending their housing rights. Some things we do include providing information and support around different housing problems, including everything from housing conditions, rent increases, as well as more recently around, you know, evictions, repossessions, and rent evictions. We also organize, you know, we also do neighborhood outreach. We organize popular education workshops and events, and we organize actions rallies and demonstrations to demand more social housing, as well as measures to keep tenants in the neighborhood.
And one of the reasons I'm talking to you right now is because of the very low vacancy rate that we have in Montreal, and then the increase in rents and in rent evictions. Are you seeing that here? Has there been a marked difference?
Yes, absolutely. So currently, according to the Canadian Mortgage and Housing Corporation's most recent numbers, the vacancy rate in Park Extension in the borough of Villeray Park Extension in Saint-Michel is around 1%, which is significantly below the 1.5% average. This is widely considered to be the lowest vacancy rate in about the last 15 years. We've also been seeing rents really skyrocketing. In a lot of instances, apartments that were maybe 1 or 2 years ago around $700, $800 a month are now going for $1,400 to $1,500 a month. We've also been seeing a wave of evictions in the neighborhood. Since we started keeping track in May 2018, we've talked to about 123 tenants who have been facing evictions, 30 between December and January alone. In a lot of instances, you know, landlords have been trying to do surface level renovation, you know, try to push tenants out of the building, do surface level renovations, and then re-rent apartments at much higher rates. Considering how high the rents are now and how scarce affordable housing is, many tenants are really struggling to find, you know, housing in the neighborhood. In some instances, this means tenants having, to live in overcrowded conditions. We've seen sometimes 2 to 3 families per apartment. In other instances, people stay in apartments that are poorly maintained where there are terrible conditions because there just aren't any other options. And then in other instances, tenants are pushed out of the neighborhood entirely.
Which is a real problem for families because the schools are here, and especially these schools in this neighborhood have the resources to deal with all the social issues that, you know, certain families have, like especially families who are in poverty and also who are newcomers to Canada or refugees or any of these things that this neighborhood offers, and it's amazing. And then if you are kicked out of your house, where do you go? And your kids lose their community, they lose their school, their teachers, their resource people.
Yeah, for a lot of people, evictions mean, you know, having to take your kids out of school. It means losing access to services. It means being cut off from your support network. I think it's important to note that, you know, Park X has historically been a neighborhood that's welcomed, you know, immigrants, people of color, you know, families, work, you know, low-wage workers and people living on low incomes. The networks that exist here can't just be easily recreated elsewhere. You know, when people are pushed out of the neighborhood, you know, in the numbers that we're seeing, eventually what it can lead to is the disintegration of the entire social fabric of a neighborhood.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that the great thing about Park X is that it does feel like a neighborhood and it does feel like community. And you walk around and you say hi, but it's more than that. It's more than just good neighbors, you know? Yeah. That relies on things like what the Cape has been doing for years and what so many other organizations and people themselves, community groups, grassroots have been doing. And to say that that renovations, that real estate is more important than that, it really, it's more than heartbreaking. But.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's often said that Park X is one of the poorest neighborhoods in Montreal, if not all of Canada. But that being said, you know, there's an enormous amount of mutual support between tenants and a lot of networks that have helped people survive, you know, despite negligent landlords or exploitative working conditions. And we're worried that all of that could be lost if tenants are, you know, displaced in large numbers from the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. So I wanted to get into, what are tenants coming to you with currently, especially like families? What are the issues that they're coming to you with, and how can they stay in the neighborhood, basically?
Over the last few months, we've been seeing a lot of tenants who are getting repossession notices, which is to say, when landlords are, you know, claiming that they want the apartment back so that they can, you know, so they can move in, or that they can move in a family member or someone for whom they're a primary source of financial support. We've also been seeing a lot of a lot of notices of eviction to enlarge, subdivide, or change the use of an apartment. For example, you know, maybe taking a large family-sized apartment, subdividing it into a bunch of smaller apartments, and then re-renting them to students and to wealthier professionals in the neighborhood. We've also been seeing a lot of renovation notices. So it's in the case of rent evictions, it's a situation where landlords use renovations as a pretext to push out tenants and then, you know, re-rent the apartments for much, much higher rates. It should be noted that actually with renovations, tenants have the right to return, and they have the right to return under the same conditions of their lease. But in a lot of instances, tenants don't know that they can oppose evictions. They don't know that they can insist on their right to return and end up being pushed out of their apartments. Another thing we've been seeing a lot of is harassment on the part of landlords, you know, coming and banging on the door every day, in some instances intimidating their children, you know, just putting constant pressure on them. Much as we've seen an enormous amount of tenants coming to see us, it's also important to note that, you know, in most instances, these are just the cases that we know of. In a lot of instances, tenants either don't know that they can oppose or are under so much pressure from their landlords that they end up, signing agreements and accepting to move out.
Yeah. And so if they did come here, you would help them kind of assert themselves legally, really.
You know, we're trying to be more present in the neighborhood. We're trying to do more flyering. We're trying to do more door-to-door, especially in buildings where we know tenants are receiving notices, just to, you know, to give tenants information about what their rights and recourse are. Other things we try to do is to put tenants in touch with each other. It's often really helpful to talk to your neighborhoods and to your neighbors in these situations. For example, with repossessions, there have been instances where tenants talk to each other and realize the landlord's trying to repossess several apartments for the same person in one building, or that, you know, another unit is already free and they could take that one instead. Those are instances, for example, where knowing that can mean that you're able to successfully defeat a repossession. In other instances, tenants have, you know, in buildings that are, you know, where all the tenants are getting eviction notices for subdividing and enlarging, have come together and have decided to collectively oppose their evictions. Tenants are much stronger when they fight these things together.
Hearing about the subdivision of large apartments, that's really upsetting too, because as a family, you know, there are people talking about, well, I can't find a 4.5, I can't find a 5.5, I have 3 kids, am I going to have to move to a 3.5 that I can afford? And then if you're already stressed by work situations or poverty or immigration applications, whatever, and then you have to push your entire family into a 3.5, that's just not a high standard of living. It's not even a moderate standard of living. These are the things that, like, I feel like governments, municipal, provincial, federal, should be protecting us from, like having to live in basically substandard housing conditions. Yeah, just because landlords want to make more money and somehow the poor get punished for that. I wanted to ask you, there are these protests and letter writing and putting pressure on different levels of government. How involved is the CAPE in that?
So we held a demonstration on February 3rd in front of the Borough Council. It's important to note that the Borough does have the power to issue permits for major renovations, and also for construction permits for evictions around changing the use or the size of a building. So we held a rally with a number of the tenants from affected buildings to demand a moratorium on issuing these notices. Beyond that, we also have been wanting to put pressure on the provincial government to put a moratorium on repossessions and on evictions, especially while we're in the midst of a housing crisis, which is to say when the vacancy rate is below 3%. We've also been calling on the city, the province, and on all levels of government, really, to invest more in social housing. It's an important way of taking buildings off of the rental market, and it's a way of ensuring people's access to social housing and keeping tenants in neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. And so far, ParkX doesn't really have a great track record for social housing, considering how much is actually needed.
No, it's, and there's, you know, like, it's important to note that actually the most recent project in Park Extension dates back to 2015, and the previous one to 2005 before that. There's been a number of missed opportunities around building social housing. We can think of, for example, the case of Homemade Bakery at the corner of Curb and Beaumont, which is in the process of being demolished to build luxury apartments that'll probably be unaffordable for the overwhelming majority of tenants in this neighborhood. It was supposed to have been purchased by the city to build 120 units of social housing, but they dragged their feet on decontamination and it ended up being sold to one of the biggest property developers in the city. The city also had set, as part of its urban economic and social development plan, a target of 225 units for the south of Park Extension and for areas surrounding the new University of Montreal campus, and they completely missed it. There's only been 154, you know, unit building that's located, one cooperative project just outside of Park Extension that's been built.
That's it. And then, speaking of the campus, mm-hmm. the Université de Montréal campus, that is one of the reasons why we're having this crunch in the neighborhood, too, because mm-hmm. landlords are seeing this opportunity to rent at higher rents mm-hmm. to groups of people, not families. A family typically has one or two incomes. When you rent to four students, they're all pitching in.
And also students tend to, you know, there's an enormous amount of turnover with students. They stay for maybe a year or two and they move out, which also allows the landlords to successively raise the rent every time somebody moves out. We're also seeing an enormous amount of discrimination in the neighborhood. At this point, a lot of landlords refuse to rent to immigrants, refuse to rent to families, and say very openly that they're only interested in renting to students and to professionals.
Is that legal?
It's completely illegal, yeah. But a lot of people don't, you know, are just unaware that they can, you know, that they can fight back in those situations.
What does the fight look like? Is that one of the reasons holding people back, that the fight is kind of psychologically or financially going to drive somebody down, like make somebody feel like, okay, this isn't worth it?
Against housing discrimination?
Against housing discrimination, against a rent eviction, against a higher rent. How hard is it?
First and foremost, we have been seeing a lot of tenants coming together and collectively fighting evictions in the neighborhood.
Which makes it easier in a way because you have community doing it with you.
Absolutely. In terms of some of the things that make it really difficult for tenants to defend their rights, first and foremost, in the case of, for example, opposing an eviction for changing the size or use of the apartment, you're the one who actually has to go down to the rental board and open a dossier against your landlord. It also, there's fees involved in opening if you're not on welfare, or you have to pay, you know, it's $91 to open a file, which if you're a low-wage worker trying to support your family, is often a significant amount of money to consider. Legal fees can be another issue. We've been seeing a lot of tenants in the neighborhood, either because they're recent immigrants who came here with some savings, or because they're elderly people who saved for their retirement, often end up being not accepted for legal aid, and then have to face significant legal fees to defend their rights as tenants. That can also be a barrier. But above all, I would say in a lot of instances, there's very little recourse available in situations of evictions. Sometimes in cases of repossessions, you can argue that, you know, a repossession is clearly in bad faith. For example, there was one case in Petite Patrie where one landlord tried to repossess 17 apartments for the same grandmother. Sometimes you can defeat repossessions, but it's often not easy. It's often extremely arbitrary and will depend on who is seeing your case at the rental board that day. Some régisseurs will listen, others will tend to defer to the landlord. So in a lot of instances, the recourse that does exist doesn't really defend tenants' rights. That's for, you know, it's for that reason that we, you know, we push back when, for example, the housing minister says that, oh, it's not a crisis, there's recourse that exists, you know, to deal with these situations. Often that's actually just not the case.
And in a lot of cases, it's just like, well, okay, I'll just move then. And it's devastating in many ways, but and it costs more money, even just to move. If you're trying to move to an apartment in this neighborhood, the apartments are not, the cost, the rents are not what they used to be. And then simply the cost of moving. So it's just making people who already don't have very much money have less money. I mean, there should be, again, there should be real recourse for that issue. It's sort of just leaving many people behind.
It just shouldn't be possible you know, it shouldn't be possible to evict, you know, evict tenants. It shouldn't be possible to transform buildings in ways that makes housing less available to people, you know, in the midst of housing crises. This is partly why we've been, you know, tenants in this neighborhood are organizing and mobilizing to demand that emergency measures be placed to deal with, you know, to deal with this crisis and to stop the displacement of Park X tenants.
And how much do you talk about housing as a human right, and how we're kind of, with the rise in real estate prices and everything, it seems like housing as a human right has been sort of pushed to the wayside.
I mean, yes, absolutely, and it's connected to so many other things. If you don't have a roof over your head, it's much more difficult to work. It's more difficult to take care of your health, to be able to afford food. I think in a lot of instances around gentrification in Montreal, I think, you know, at some point as a city, like, there's going to be decisions to be made. Do we want Montreal to be a city where families, where low-income people can still live, or do we just want it to become, you know, a place for the rich?
So we can have many actions, form of actions, but how do we get the people who have the power to make these decisions to really listen and do things that are in the interests of people who have less money in this city, or who just simply don't own land or don't even have a possibility of owning land?
I mean, definitely, I think it's important that, you know, we mobilize as tenants to, you know, to put pressure not only on levels of government, but also on landlords, on real estate developers, on those who want to profit off of, you know, who want to profit off of the displacement of tenants. It's been encouraging to see, you know, tenants mobilizing in many neighborhoods. What's happening in Park X, like, there's definitely things about Park X's situation that is, you know, that is unique. But what's happening in Park X is playing out across the city at this point, right? We're starting to see repossessions for the first time in Mont-Royal-Nord. We're starting to see rent evictions in Cartierville with the arrival of the REM train. The vacancy rate in Saint-Henri is hovering around 0.3% at the moment. And, you know, tenants have been mobilizing in neighborhoods. Just earlier this month in Plateau, they completely shut down the borough council meeting. There was, I think, 100 tenants there all speaking out about their experiences. I think if we come together as tenants that were present on the ground, that were disruptive, I think these are things that can, you know, that can put pressure and allow for measures to be adopted to rein in this housing crisis.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are thousands of us, even in Park X alone. You know, it's the majority, the vast majority of people who rent here.
80% of people in this neighborhood are tenants, right? That's, you know, most, the overwhelming majority of us are, you know, our tenants are affected by this.
And the truth is, our position is becoming more precarious, even if we're, quote unquote, the lucky ones. You know, that's what people always say across the city. I'm lucky, I have a good landlord. Well, for how long? That's what I always wonder. I have a good landlord, but for how long? When are they going to sell? I don't know.
I think there's definitely ways in which, in which race, class, immigration status, and things make different people more, you know, much more vulnerable to these things. I do think it's important for us to come together and to...
Even if you have all the privileges that kind of, you know, let you be one of the lucky ones, as it were. But we do need, even if you think your housing situation isn't precarious, we need to mobilize together. You know, it's not only when the situation happens to me that I should be taking part, right?
Yeah. And there are things that people, you know, for example, if people are moving, like transfer your lease. There's lots of people who, you know, who are, you know, facing eviction, who may not have a place to go. on July 1st who are very much hoping to remain in this neighborhood so that their kids don't have to change schools, so that they can be close, to their places of worship, and they can be close to, their friends, their families, and their networks. Transfer your lease. When you move into a new place, check Section G on your lease. Has that been filled out? Try to find out from previous tenants, what was the rent before? If there's been a huge increase, challenge it. That can be an important way of keeping rents low. In a couple of weeks, people are going to start receiving, are going to start receiving rent increase notices. You have the right to refuse rent increases. It's often a good idea to do so as a way of keeping rents low.
Mm-hmm. And that you have to refuse in writing, that
yep,
one.
You it doesn't have to happen refuse in writing within 30 days of receiving the notice, after which point your landlord then has to decide whether they want to go to the rental board for a fixation hearing.
Absolutely. And that information of how much the rent can be increased is on the CAPE website. It's also on the government's, the provincial government's website, too.
Absolutely. The Régie de Logement issues indicators every year. However, in a context where there's a housing, where there's a housing shortage, where the vacancy rate is low and where rents are going up, landlords often try to take advantage of the context to try to push through increases that are much higher than what is suggested by the Régie. And they do so knowing that, a lot of people are afraid of losing their apartments and may just accept them. In that context, it is all the more important to refuse increases and to help keep rents affordable.
Okay, so if a landlord's saying, I'm going to increase your rent by $15 and it's a $1,000 apartment, that's still too much. Actually, if they haven't done any renovations or anything.
It always varies a little bit. It'll depend on, who's paying for heating, what kind of heating is available, what have been the changes in municipal and school taxes. But yeah, there is a calculation you can do that can at least give you an estimate of what your landlord should probably be suggesting. And often, if it seems higher than what it is, it may be a good idea to challenge it.
Okay. And yeah, it matters not just to you, but to anybody else who might live in that apartment in the future.
And in your neighborhood in general.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, every rent affects the rent next door kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so to get back to families, often when you're a parent, you don't have a lot of extra energy to give to these things, right? And you have to, so it's good to know that places like the CAPE are here and that we can talk to our neighbors or other people in the building. But, I mean, how do you talk to somebody who is a parent about things like this if they have just a little bit of energy for it, but maybe not a lot of energy for it, for refusing a rent increase, for, trying to refuse a rent eviction?
I do think it's important to be mindful of the different barriers and challenges that people face. As part of the reason, for example, why we try to go door to door, why we try to meet people where they are, why we try to do workshops in different community groups across the neighborhood as a way of finding people where they are.
Really outreach rather than waiting for people to come to us.
We send the rent increase calculations in a huge mail out to the entire neighborhood. Every year is a way of making sure that people get their hands on information that's important, especially if, maybe they're busy, they're juggling multiple priorities, and it's difficult for them to come down and see us. I think absolutely we need to be mindful of the kind of, of the ways in which it's difficult sometimes for families to refuse increases, to challenge evictions. I think some things we try to do, find lawyers who are willing, put people in touch with lawyers who are willing to accept legal aid, or in some instances we're willing to do stuff pro bono if the fees are just too high. We try to get people to challenge things together where possible.
What about other people in the community who may have gone through similar things like this? Do you sort of connect people, say, oh, somebody is volunteering to help somebody write a letter?
No, but it's not a bad idea.
I think sometimes, I see this as far as the lease transfer issue or people helping each other out with writing letters. Mm-hmm. It happens a lot through social media. There are a few Facebook Park X groups. There are lots of neighborhood groups.
We try to have things like model letters,
yes.
And things, to make the process easier and less time consuming. We make it a point to offer childcare at every workshop and event that we organize. We try to do things at times that are relatively accessible for parents. For example, one of our workshops we held in the afternoon with the understanding that maybe if someone's kids are at school, it might be easier for them to come. You know, we try to find times that work for parents that can, yeah.
Well, that sounds really great. And as upsetting a situation as it is, it's always good to know that there are things we can do about that and ways that we can help ourselves and our neighbors, and that there are community resources to do that with. And if people want to come here, it's in the basement of the William Hingston building, which is quite central to Park X. Do they have to make an appointment?
No need to make an appointment. You can just drop in. We're open from on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday from 9:30 to 11:30, and then from 1:30 to 4:30. For tenants who live in Park Extension, if you don't live in Park Extension, give us a call and we can put you in touch with the housing committee in your neighborhood.
Great. Thanks so much, Amy.
Thanks so much.
Thanks to Amy Darwish for talking with me earlier this year. You can find out more at the CAPE website, which is committeedactionparkx.org, and it's also located in the William Hingston building on St. Rock in Park X. I'm going to play a song now called This Too Shall Pass by Montreal band 10,000 Horses from their album Le Grand Silence.
Most wounds don't heal fast.
You're listening to In the Motherhood here on CKUT 90.3 FM. And in the second half of our show, I'll be playing an interview borrowed from CKUT show Free City Radio. And Free City Radio host Stefan Christoph talked with organizer and media co-op founder Drew Oyeje last month about a jobs guarantee and the path to a green recovery, which is a highly relevant topic at this time during a pandemic when many people have lost their jobs or are working low-wage part-time jobs to make ends meet. You can listen to more Free City Radio episodes, learn more about the show on CKUT and on the Free City Radio SoundCloud page.
I'm on the line with Drew Oyeje, who is a community organizer, a writer, and is involved with the Courage Coalition. This week, on September 30th, 2020, Courage Coalition put out a document to call for a jobs guarantee. This is mirroring efforts in different parts of the world to rethink frameworks of employment towards just work, but also towards a green transition in the context of the economic crisis resulting from the pandemic. Hey, Drew.
Hello.
Hey. I was just hoping to ask you a few questions, if you could break down what this means, the framework of a jobs guarantee in the Canadian context. So first of all, can you just highlight why you feel it's important to put out this idea right now in the context of Canada?
Well, the context of Canada is that we have an economic system where generally it's understood that the normal functioning of the system has about 1 million people unemployed at any given time. And that's not counting people who have stopped looking for work. That's people who are actively want a job and don't have one. So that's 1 million people who, you know, if they don't have other means, if they don't have, you know, family members, or they don't have, you know, other access to income, are in a pretty desperate situation. And one can say probably living in a pretty high degree of stress and misery. And that includes obviously any dependents they have. So this is a situation that leads to like a significant amount of poverty and misery. So that's the framework that Canada is normally in. But then you add COVID to the equation, and the number of unemployed people has gone up as like doubled, basically more or less doubled, to about 2 million people, more than 2 million people. So you have a situation where I think people are understanding on a much kind of more direct way, you know, how the effects of an economic system that lets people be unemployed, but then also punishes them for being unemployed. You know, we do have unemployment insurance, which is something that social movements fought for in the early part of the 20th century, and were able to win, but which has been sort of steadily eroded. Certainly liberal governments under Paul Martin started taking billions of dollars of unemployment insurance that people paid for and putting them into general funds. And so effectively what that means is that people's unemployment insurance money was being taken from them and made and turned into corporate tax cuts, more or less.
Okay. I just want to hold on just for a minute there. 2 points. Can you talk a bit more about the point you raised that in general, there's about 1 million people unemployed in Canada, and that is part of the economic framework of the contemporary neoliberal Canadian economy. Can you explain that a bit more?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, back in the day, there was such a thing as having an economic goal of having full employment. And what we've seen in the neoliberal era is that that's fallen by the wayside. And effectively, the reason for this is because you know, if you look at all the sort of graphs of the neoliberal era, you see productivity is steadily rising, but incomes are not rising. So basically, we're doing more work and producing more for the same or less pay, and that's the sort of signature trend of neoliberalism. And I think one of the big ways that that's been accomplished has been making sure that there's a big reserve of people who are not employed, so that So that effectively people are competing with each other for a limited number of jobs. And there's a certain fear factor in keeping one's job and not fighting for better conditions or asking for better conditions, because there is this, you know, one does not want to join the ranks of these million and now 2 million people who are in Canada who are in this kind of pretty desperate situation of, you know, scraping by, you know, barely surviving on welfare or trying to deal with unemployment or having to couch surf, be homeless, you know, any number of things. So I think that's a really potent tool for the current economic system to keep wages low and to keep people competing with each other to work for lower wages. But that's not necessary. That's not a necessary thing. I mean, there has been a lot of talk of in the past of full employment as a sort of an economic goal that one might aspire to. And I think that we haven't seen that for several decades, I don't think. And that's basically what a jobs guarantee says. It says, look, anybody who wants work should have it. You know, we're the richest society in human history, more or less. We can afford it. We can do that. You know, the money's there. We know where it is. It's just a question of the political will to go and find it. And by creating a jobs guarantee, by basically saying, anybody who wants a job can either enter a full-time training to get the skills to do a job, or they can start doing a job, whether, you know, if it's more entry-level stuff or if they already have the skills. It's that simple. You just pay people to do the work that needs to be done. And part of our statement is there is a lot of work that needs to be done. We need to transform the economy into a zero-carbon economy, basically. We need to completely change the way we deal with housing, the way we deal with transportation, the way we deal with production. I mean, it's a top to bottom sort of, transformation of our economic system and our technologies and everything that has to happen basically in the next 9 years. This is what the UN says, basically. So in this context, it makes a lot of sense to go find the money where it is. It's in tax havens, it's in billionaires' bank accounts, it's in the stock market, it's in corporate profits. Corporations are sitting on $700 billion in cash that they're not investing in the economy. They're just investing in short-term, sort of speculation, often driving privatization, which drains productivity. And so there's all kinds of sources of cash that we could go and access and use for the common good, use to transform the economy in the way that everybody understands and says we have to, but just nobody has, there's no single force that has the political will to say, okay, we're actually going to do it. And so you have this increasingly ridiculous situation where, the BC NDP most recently just said, oh yeah, we're going to reach a carbon neutral economy by 2050. Setting aside the idea of a carbon neutral economy as opposed to a carbon zero economy, which is questionable, but the main point there is they understand that they need to get there, but at the exact same time, they're investing billions of dollars into natural gas subsidies. So how do those two things square? The answer is they don't. But we don't have a better, answer for how to shift toward that economy. We just know that we have to get there. Everybody agrees we have to get there. It's just nobody's actually doing the things that are necessary to get there. So a job guarantee, I think, could be a major tool in that respect.
So on this point, I mean, there is a lot of rhetoric from the Liberal government about taking action on the climate and transforming elements of life in these territories. But I'm wondering if you could cut through some of the ways that the ideas you're talking about and the urgency also of the issues and the transformation needed around the looming disaster of climate change the ways that the current Liberal government plans fall short. Maybe highlight 2 points on this.
Yeah, I don't think it'll be news to anybody, but you know, the fact that they spent several billion dollars, to buy a pipeline, and then to expand it, is certainly a major problem. I mean, we're talking about creating new capacity to expand the fossil fuel industry at the exact moment when it needs to be shrinking, like, rapidly. So that's one. And then another one is, I think, their large scale, you know, I think this has passed under the radar, but they're, to a large extent, but their large scale commitment to privatization as a paradigm. The Infrastructure Bank has put, over $100 billion allocated toward building infrastructure, but the way they're building it is by attracting private capital. And private capital, needs a return on investment. That's what it exists to do, is get a return on investment. And so when at a time when you could be loaning for like historically low interest rates of like 2% or lower, as the Canadian state, you can access extremely low interest rates. Instead of doing that, they're paying like 15% or sometimes as high as 15% to this private capital for really no apparent reason, except that it's nice for private capital to make a big return on investment. And they're friends with them. Like, that's really the only reason. And they haven't been called out about it. But I mean, at a time when we need to be building infrastructure, taking a 15% hit on, or a, you know, net 13% hit on the, just on the loans that you need to build that infrastructure is a, never mind the cost of, you know, going with a, you know, privatized contractors and everything. Is going to be a major liability in terms of your ability to transition to green infrastructure. At a time when you need public transportation to be as widely accessible as possible and as rapidly expanding as possible. We're talking about tens of billions of dollars that we're just throwing into the trash effectively in terms of that is allocated for green infrastructure and that should be spent on that, but is not actually being spent on that.
Mm-hmm. Last point, I just wanted to go back to the point of jobs guarantee and sort of the framing of employment and work. Until now, most discourse on even the, from the NDP to the Liberals to the Conservatives, places the onus of employment on the worker, not on the system. And can you talk about how the jobs guarantee sort of tries to address the problems of that narrative?
Yeah, I think when you look at the labor market, I think because we're immersed in a situation where our understanding of the labor market is that people, is that workers compete with each other to get jobs, and that's not. That's not a given. That's not necessarily how it has to be. We could easily reverse it if we had the political will through a jobs guarantee or strong employment insurance reform or raising welfare rates or any number of other means to make it so that employers are competing with each other to hire workers. Even better, we have some kind of economic planning where we set up an economy that that allocates work not on the basis of who's gonna who has access to the social circles or the education to do a job, but based on other things like, what's the environmental impact of locating jobs in a certain place, or what's the social benefit of, distributing jobs. If you want to get really radical, you can say like, why is it someone's job to be a janitor, for 12-hour days, and nobody else has to clean? why doesn't everybody do that sort of not terrible and certainly dignified in small quantities kind of work for like a few hours a week, so that everybody can have like a fully dignified existence, as opposed to like that kind of difficult, invisible work being dumped on, basically the most marginal and the most hyper exploited populations who have been shut out of other parts of the workforce. Why do we have to arrange things that way? So there's all the point is, once you get beyond like this kind of fixed idea that we have of like employment being something that employees compete for, and that corporations are so very benevolent and generous to us to supply us, and instead say like, look, like all labor is what creates value, and we have the collective capacity as a society to organize ourselves in all kinds of ways, through cooperatives, through public services, through private businesses, through work trades, through all kinds of different things to design the way we spend our days and the way we allocate our productivity. And I think we need to get to a point where we start to apply the ideas of democracy and collaboration and cooperation to the ways that we spend our most productive hours and our creativity and our human capacities, instead of subordinating that to, basically what banks think are valuable, but instead not subordinating it, but actively putting it in service of what we as a society, as communities, as neighborhoods, as families, think is valuable, and to really put the economic power back in the hands of all those entities, not just private capital, which is the current situation that we're in, which is, obviously leading to this absolutely dismal situation. There's another way to do it.
Thank you, Drew.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Hope that was helpful. Take
it was
care.
Great. Couragecoalition.ca is where the document is.
Thanks for listening to In the Motherhood today on CKUT 90.3 FM. That was an interview borrowed from Free City Radio. Thanks to Stefan Christoph for talking about that important topic, the path to a green recovery. We'll be back next month on December 16th talking with parents about their experiences with schools and childcare in the past couple of months in Montreal. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can email us at inthemotherhood@ckut.ca. My name is Robin. Thank you for listening. Thank you for listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. And this is a song called The Trip by Montreal-based music maker Moonstar. It's featuring a 2005 Washington, D.C. rally speech by NBA player Etan Thomas. So it's something that's political and you can dance to it. Thanks for listening.
Giving all honor, thanks, and praises to God for courage and wisdom. This is a very important rally. I'd like to thank you for allowing me to share my thoughts, feelings, and concerns regarding a tremendous problem that we are currently facing. This problem is universal, transcending race, economic background, religion, and culture. And this problem is none other than the current administration, which has set up shop in the White House. In fact, I'd like to take some of these cats on a field trip. I want to get a big yellow buses with no air conditioner and no seatbelts and round up Bill O'Reilly, Pat Buchanan, Trent Lott, Sean Hannity, Dick Cheney, Jeb Bush, Bush Jr. and Bush Sr., John Ashcroft, Giuliani, Ed Gillespie, Catherine Harris, that little bow tie Tucker Carlson, and any other right-wing conservative Republicans I can think of. Them all on the trip to the hood. Not to do no 30-minute documentary. I mean, I want to drop them off and leave them there. Let them become one with the other side of the tracks. Get them four mouths to feed and no wealth.
let them know how it feels to be an employee at will, able to be fired at the drop of a hat. I'd take away their opportunities, then try their children as adults, sending their 13-year-old babies to life in prison. Child shall be left behind and take more money out of their schools. Tell them to show and prove themselves on standardized exams, testing their knowledge on things that they haven't been taught, and then I'd call them inferior. I'd soak into their interior notions of endless possibilities. I'd paint pictures of assisted productivity if they only agree to be all they can be. Dress them up with fatigues and boots with promises of pots of gold at the end of rainbows. Free education to waste terrain on those who finish their bid. Then I'd close the lid on that barrel of fool's gold by starting a war, sending their children into the midst of a hostile situation. And while they're worried about their babies being murdered and slain in foreign lands, I'd grace them with the pain of being sick and unable to get medicine. Give them health benefits that barely cover the common cold. John Q would become their reality as HMOs introduce them to the world of inferior care, filling their lungs with inadequate air, penny pinching at the expense of patients, doctors practicing medicine in an intricate web of rationing and regulations. Patients wonder the maze of managed bureaucracy. Costs rise and quality quickly deteriorates, but they say that managed care is cheaper. They'll say that free choice in medicine will defeat the overall productivity. And as co-payments are steadily rising, I'll make their grandparents have to choose between buying their medicine and paying their rent. Way to be. Then, very contradictingly, I'd fight for the spread of the death penalty as if thou shalt not kill applies to babies but not to criminals. Then, I introduce them to those sworn to protect and serve, creating a curve in their trust in the law. I show them the nightsticks and plungers, the pepper spray and stun guns, the mace and magnets that they'll soon become acquainted with, the shakedowns and illegal search and seizures, the planted evidence of being stopped for no reason, harassment ain't even a hammer. 41 shots with two raised hands, cell phones and wallets that are confused with illegal contraband. I'd introduce them to pigs who love making their guns click like wine glasses. Surrounded by bullets, making them a walking bullseye, a living piñata, held at the mercy of police brutality. And then we'll see if they finally weren't aware of the truth. If their eyes were finally opened like a box of Pandora, I'd show them how the other side of the tracks carries the weight of the world on our shoulders, and how society seems to be holding us down with the force of a boulder. The bird of democracy flew the coop back in Florida. Song. Injustice comes in packs like wolves in sheep's clothing. TKO'd by the right hooks of life, many are left staggering under the weight of the day, leaning against the ropes of...
and welcome to Amandla, 1 hour of African current affairs brought to you in English and sometimes in French here on CQT 90.3 FM, cqt.ca around the world. So tonight, Doug, what I'm going to be taking a look at, or not taking a look at, we're actually going to be featuring an excerpt of an interview of Wole Soyinka being interviewed by Chris Abani. Both are award-winning Nigerian writers from two different generations. Both are critical and outspoken voices, and both have been imprisoned for their writing. It's a terrific conversation, so we'll be playing that. We'll be playing that tonight. What about you, Doug?
Well, I'm looking at the recent election in Tanzania and how Tanzania has fallen far away from the roots of Nyerere's Ujamaa socialism, and I'm taking a brief look at the most recent excitement here in North America about the COVID vaccines that are coming around. And how it's a me first problem that is very problematic for the rest of the world. So stay tuned to Amandla.